a faded brown. The dress was perfect for an orphan, and I was relieved at how easy finding the costumes had been, until I remembered that in Act Two, Annie wears beautiful dresses, which Daddy Warbucks buys for her. I didn't have anything like that. I told Mother, and her face sank. We drove 100 miles round trip, searching every second-hand shop along the way, but found nothing. Sitting in the parking lot of the last shop, Mother pursed her lips, then said, "There's one more place we can try." She drove to my Aunt Angie's and parked in front of the white picket fence she shared with Grandma. Mother knocked, then stood back from the door and smoothed her hair. Angie looked surprised to see us. Mother rarely visited her sister, but she smiled warmly and invited us in. Her front room reminded me of fancy hotel lobbies from the movies. There was so much silk and lace. Mother and I sat on a pleated sofa of pale pink while Mother explained why we'd come. Angie said her daughter had a few dresses that might do. Mother waited on the pink sofa while Angie led me upstairs to her daughter's room and laid out an armful of dresses, each so fine, with such intricate lace patterns and delicately tied bows, that at first I was afraid to touch them. Angie helped me into each one, knotting the sashes, fastening the buttons, plumping the bows. "You should take this one," she said, passing me a navy dress with white braided cords arranged across the bodice. "Grandma sewed this detailing." I took the dress, along with another made of red velvet, collared with white lace, and Mother and I drove home. The play opened a week later. Dad was in the front row. When the performance ended, he marched right to the box office and bought tickets for the next night. It was all he talked about that Sunday in church, not doctors or the Illuminati or Y2K, just the play over in town where his youngest daughter was singing the lead. Dad didn't stop me from auditioning for the next play, or the one after that, even though he worried about me spending so much time away from home.
"There's no telling what kind of cavorting takes place in that theater," he said. "It's probably a den of adulterers and fornicators."
When the director of the next play got divorced, it confirmed Dad's suspicions. He said he hadn't kept me out of the public school for all these years just to see me corrupted on a stage. Then he drove me to the rehearsal. Nearly every night he said he was going to put a stop to my going, that one evening he'd just show up at Worm Creek and haul me home. But each time a play opened, he was there, in the front row. Sometimes he played the part of an agent or manager, correcting my technique or suggesting songs for my repertoire, even advising me about my health. That winter, I caught a procession of sore throats and couldn't sing, and one night, Dad called me to him and pried my mouth open to look at my tonsils.
"They're swollen, all right," he said. "Big as apricots."
When Mother couldn't get the swelling down with echinacea and calendula, Dad suggested his own remedy.
"People don't know it, but the sun is the most powerful medicine we have. That's why people don't get sore throats in summer."
He nodded, as if approving of his own logic, then said,
"If I had tonsils like yours, I'd go outside every morning and stand in the sun with my mouth open. Let those rays seep in for a half hour or so. They'll shrink in no time."
He called it a treatment. I did it for a month. It was uncomfortable, standing with my jaw dropped and my head tilted back so the sun could shine into my throat. I never lasted a whole half hour. My jaw would ache after 10 minutes, and I'd half freeze standing motionless in the Idaho winter. I kept catching more sore throats, and any time Dad noticed I was a bit croaky, he'd say,
"Well, what do you expect? I ain't seen you getting treatment all week."
It was at the Worm Creek Opera House that I first saw him, a boy I didn't know laughing with a group of public school kids wearing big white shoes, khaki shorts, and a wide grin. He wasn't in the play, but there wasn't much to do in town, and I saw him several more times that week when he turned up to visit his friends. Then, one night, when I was wandering alone in the dark wings backstage, I turned a corner and found him sitting on the wooden crate that was a favorite haunt of mine. The crate was isolated. That was why I liked it. He shifted to the right, making room for me. I sat slowly, tensely, as if the seat were made of needles. "I'm Charles," he said. There was a pause while he waited for me to give my name, but I didn't. "I saw you in the last play," he said after a moment. "I wanted to tell you something." I braced myself, for what I wasn't sure. Then he said, "I wanted to tell you that your singing is about the best I ever heard." I came home one afternoon from packing macadamias to find Dad and Richard gathered around a large metal box which they'd hefted onto the kitchen table. While Mother and I cooked meatloaf, they assembled the contents. It took more than an hour, and when they'd finished, they stood back, revealing what looked like an enormous military green telescope with its long barrel set firmly atop a short, broad tripod. Richard was so excited he was hopping from one foot to the other, reciting what it could do. "Got a range more than a mile. Can bring down a helicopter." Dad stood quietly, his eyes shining. "What is it?" I asked.
"It's a 50 caliber rifle," he said. "Want to try it?"
I peered through the scope, searching the mountainside, fixing distant stalks of wheat between its crosshairs. The meatloaf was forgotten. We charged outside. It was past sunset. The horizon was dark. I watched as Dad lowered himself to the frozen ground, positioned his eye at the scope, and after what felt like an hour, pulled the trigger. The blast was thunderous. I had both palms pressed to my ears, but after the initial boom, I dropped them, listening as the shot echoed through the ravines. He fired again and again, so that by the time we went inside, my ears were ringing. I could barely hear Dad's reply when I asked what the gun was for.
"Defense," he said.
The next night, I had a rehearsal at Worm Creek. I was perched on my crate, listening to the monologue being performed on stage, when Charles appeared and sat next to me.
"You don't go to school," he said.
It wasn't a question.
"You should come to choir. You'd like choir."
"Maybe," I said, and he smiled. A few of his friends stepped into the wing and called to him. He stood and said goodbye, and I watched him join them, taking in the easy way they joked together and imagining an alternate reality in which I was one of them. I imagined Charles inviting me to his house to play a game or watch a movie and felt a rush of pleasure. But when I pictured Charles visiting Buck's Peak, I felt something else, something like panic. What if he found the root cellar? What if he discovered the fuel tank? Then I understood, finally, what the rifle was for. That mighty barrel with its special range that could reach from the mountain to the valley was a defensive perimeter for the house, for our supplies, because Dad said we would be driving when everyone else was hot-footing it. We would have food, too, when everyone else was starving, looting. Again, I imagined Charles climbing the hill to our house, but in my imagination, I was on the ridge, and I was watching his approach through crosshairs. Christmas was sparse that year. We weren't poor. Mother's business was doing well, and Dad was still scrapping, but we'd spent everything on supplies. Before Christmas, we continued our preparations as if every action, every minor addition to our stores might make the difference between surviving and not. After Christmas, we waited.
"When the hour of need arises," Dad said, "the time of preparation has passed."
The days dragged on, and then it was December 31st. Dad was calm at breakfast, but under his tranquility, I sensed excitement and something like longing. He'd been waiting for so many years, burying guns and stockpiling food and warning others to do the same. Everyone at church had read the prophecies. They knew the days of abomination were coming, but still they'd teased Dad. They'd laughed at him. Tonight, he would be vindicated. After dinner, Dad studied Isaiah for hours. At around 10, he closed his Bible and turned on the TV. The television was new. Aunt Angie's husband worked for a satellite TV company, and he'd offered Dad a deal on a subscription. No one had believed it when Dad said yes, but in retrospect, it was entirely characteristic for my father to move, in the space of a day, from no TV or radio to full-blown cable. I sometimes wondered if Dad allowed the television that year, specifically because he knew it would all disappear on January 1st. Perhaps he did it to give us a little taste of the world before it was swept away. Dad's favorite program was The Honeymooners, and that night there was a special, with episodes playing back to back. We watched, waiting for the end. I checked the clock every few minutes from 10 until 11, then every few seconds until midnight. Even Dad, who was rarely stirred by anything outside himself, glanced often at the clock. 11:59. I held my breath. One more minute, I thought, before everything is gone. Then it was 12 o'clock. The TV was still buzzing, its lights dancing across the carpet. I wondered if our clock was fast. I went to the kitchen and turned on the tap. We had water. Dad stayed still, his eyes on the screen. I returned to the couch. 12:05. How long would it take for the electricity to fail? Was there a reserve somewhere that was keeping it going these few extra minutes? The black and white specters of Ralph and Alice Cramden argued over a meatloaf. 12:10. I waited for the screen to flicker and die. I was trying to take it all in, this last luxurious moment of sharp yellow light, of warm air flowing from the heater. I was experiencing nostalgia for the life I'd had before, which I would lose at any second when the world turned and began to devour itself. The longer I sat motionless, breathing deeply, trying to inhale the last scent of the fallen world, the more I resented its continuing solidity. Nostalgia turned to fatigue. Sometime after 1:30, I went to bed. I glimpsed Dad as I left, his face frozen in the dark, the light from the TV leaping across his square glasses. He sat as if posed, with no agitation, no embarrassment, as if there were a perfectly mundane explanation for why he was sitting up, alone, at near 2 in the morning, watching Ralph and Alice Cramden prepare for a Christmas party. He seemed smaller to me than he had that morning. The disappointment in his features was so childlike, for a moment I wondered how God could deny him this. He, a faithful servant, who suffered willingly just as Noah had willingly suffered to build the ark. But God withheld the flood. Chapter 10. Shield of Feathers. When January 1st dawned like any other morning, it broke Dad's spirit. He never again mentioned Y2K. He slipped into despondency, dragging himself in from the junkyard each night, silent and heavy. He'd sit in front of the TV for hours, a black cloud hovering. Mother said it was time for another trip to Arizona. Luke was serving a mission for the church, so it was just me, Richard, and Audrey who piled into the old Chevy Astro van Dad had fixed up. Dad removed the seats, except the two in front, and in their place he put a queen mattress. Then he heaved himself onto it and didn't move for the rest of the drive. As it had years before, the Arizona sun revived Dad. He lay out on the porch on the hard cement, soaking it up, while the rest of us read or watched TV. After a few days, he began to improve, and we braced ourselves for the nightly arguments between him and Grandma. Grandma was seeing a lot of doctors these days because she had cancer in her bone marrow.
"Those doctors will just kill you quicker," Dad said one evening when Grandma returned from a consultation.
Grandma refused to quit chemotherapy, but she did ask Mother about herbal treatments. Mother had brought some with her, hoping Grandma would ask, and Grandma tried them. Foot soaks in red clay, cups of bitter parsley tea, tinctures of horsetail and hydrangea.
"Those herbs won't do a damned thing," Dad said. "Herbals operate by faith. You can't put your trust in a doctor, then ask the Lord to heal you."
Grandma didn't say a word. She just drank her parsley tea. I remember watching Grandma, searching for signs that her body was giving way. I didn't see any. She was the same taut, undefeated woman. The rest of the trip blurs in my memory, leaving me with only snapshots of Mother muscle-testing remedies for Grandma, of Grandma listening silently to Dad, of Dad sprawled out in the dry heat. Then I'm in a hammock on the back porch, rocking lazily in the orange light of the desert sunset, and Audrey appears and says, "Dad wants us to get our stuff, we're leaving." Grandma is incredulous. "After what happened last time," she shouts, "you're going to drive through the night again? What about the storm?" Dad says we'll beat the storm. While we load the van, Grandma paces, cussing. She says Dad hasn't learned a damn thing. Richard drives the first 6 hours. I lie in the back on the mattress with Dad and Audrey. It's 3 in the morning, and we are making our way from southern to northern Utah when the weather changes from the dry chill of the desert to the freezing gales of an alpine winter. Ice claims the road. Snowflakes flick against the windshield like tiny insects, a few at first, then so many the road disappears. We push forward into the heart of the storm. The van skids and jerks. The wind is furious, the view out the window pure white. Richard pulls over. He says we can't go any further. Dad takes the wheel. Richard moves to the passenger seat, and Mother lies next to me and Audrey on the mattress. Dad pulls onto the highway and accelerates, rapidly, as if to make a point, until he has doubled Richard's speed.
"Shouldn't we drive slower?" Mother asks.
Dad grins.
"I'm not driving faster than our angels can fly."
The van is still accelerating, to 50, then to 60. Richard sits tensely, his hand clutching the armrest, his knuckles bleaching each time the tires slip. Mother lies on her side, her face next to mine, taking small sips of air each time the van fishtails, then holding her breath as Dad corrects and it snakes back into the lane. She is so rigid, I think she might shatter. My body tenses with hers. Together, we brace 100 times for impact. It is a relief when the van finally leaves the road. I awoke to blackness. Something ice cold was running down my back. We're in a lake, I thought. Something heavy was on top of me, the mattress. I tried to kick it off, but couldn't, so I crawled beneath it, my hands and knees pressing into the ceiling of the van, which was upside down. I came to a broken window. It was full of snow. Then I understood. We were in a field, not a lake. I crawled through the broken glass and stood unsteadily. I couldn't seem to gain my balance. I looked around, but saw no one. The van was empty. My family was gone. I circled the wreck twice before I spied Dad's hunched silhouette on the hillock in the distance. I called to him, and he called to the others, who were spread out through the field. Dad waded toward me through the snowdrifts, and as he stepped into a beam from the broken headlights, I saw a 6-inch gash in his forearm and blood slashing into the snow. I was told later that I'd been unconscious, hidden under the mattress for several minutes. They'd shouted my name. When I didn't answer, they thought I must have been thrown from the van through the broken window, so they'd left to search for me. Everyone returned to the wreck and stood around it awkwardly, shaking, either from the cold or from shock. We didn't look at Dad, didn't want to accuse. The police arrived, then an ambulance. I don't know who called them. I didn't tell them I'd lost consciousness. I was afraid they'd take me to a hospital. I just sat in the police car next to Richard, wrapped in a reflective blanket like the one I had in my Head for the Hills bag. We listened to the radio while the cops asked Dad why the van wasn't insured and why he'd removed the seats and seatbelts. We were far from Buck's Peak, so the cops took us to the nearest police station. Dad called Tony, but Tony was trucking long haul. He tried Sean next. No answer. We would later learn that Sean was in jail that night, having been in some